Hey, everybody. Thanks for starting another week with us. It is Monday, March 11th. You're listening to the Mo News Podcast. I'm Moshe Wanunu.
And I'm Jill Wagner. This is the place where we bring you just the facts.
And we read all the news and read between the lines so you don't have to. And I hope everyone is recovering, Jill, including yourself, from the daylight saving switch. This weekend was 1 hour shorter than every other weekend.
And you might have noticed as you got up this morning, it was a little bit darker, perhaps.
Jill, way to focus on glass half empty. I focus on the fact that it was lighter later. That was the point of this whole thing.
Actually, in my world, the fact that it's staying darker later in the morning is very good because my kids sleep a little bit later. Mm. So when it was getting really light by 6 a.m., it was harder for my son to stay sleeping a little bit later. So for me, that is glass half full.
Right. Though I should say, as we get into spring and summer here in the Northern Hemisphere, it's going to be light all the time, Jill. Early sunrise and late sunset. So a transition for all of us. I just want to note also today marks the beginning of Ramadan, the month-long Muslim holy holiday. So Ramadan Mubarak to all who celebrate. Good luck with the daytime fast from sunrise to sunset, speaking of sunrises and sunsets. And Jill, one other note. In South Florida over the weekend, in Miami Friday night, we had our first ever Mo News Premium meetup.
Mosh, I was waiting for a FaceTime. I never got it, which makes me feel like it was a very successful event. If you guys were thinking, what could we do? Oh, let's FaceTime Jill. Then it probably was a little bit of a snoozer. So tell me about it. How was it?
Jill, frankly, you should have FaceTimed in.
True. Okay.
I was distracted by all the people, including some who drove almost 2 hours from West Palm Beach down to South Beach, Miami. To come meet up with us. By the way, I promised those of you who messaged us from Boca Raton, West Palm, etc., we will try to do something closer to your neck of the woods next time we are in Florida. But it was great to meet some of the, we call them the Mo News team, the people who joined Mo News Premium. Got to meet the spouses, got to meet the kids, and people got each other's numbers. They're like, oh my God, you're a Mo News fan too. We live, you know, a couple blocks away from each other. So it was a great opportunity to meet people and also a great networking opportunity.
I know this is a podcast. And for everyone who's not watching on YouTube, I am literally smiling ear to ear. That warms my heart. I am so happy about the community that we are building here. And I was going to say, I am actually planning to be in Boca Raton. I know I'm not quite the draw that the big guy is.
Oh, Joey.
But if anyone wanted to meet, I would be happy to do it at the end of April so we could figure out a date.
We hope to do these more and more across the country. And right now we're just starting with smaller group, which is if you're a member of Mo News Premium, you get access to these events. So yet another reason, Jill, as we've told you on the podcast, to join Mo News Premium, all the extra content, support us, but also a chance to partake in these in-person events. So we'll be doing more and more of those, especially as the weather gets better.
Okay, now let's get to some news here. The situation in Haiti continues to deteriorate. The United States has evacuated some of its non-essential personnel at the embassy. We'll have a status update. A new push to ban TikTok in the United States.
And why former President Trump is now against a ban, a reversal from his view when he was president.
To the Middle East, a growing divide between Biden and Bibi. Questions about Katie Britt's GOP response to the State of the Union as Britt gets the SNL treatment.
Yeah, you might have seen Scarlett Johansson in the cold open over the weekend.
Hate going through security at the airport. The TSA is experimenting with self-service.
Like the self-checkout lines at your grocery store, but this time at the airport.
And the royal family finally releasing a photo of Princess Kate, the first since her abdominal surgery. And Moshe is on this day in history.
Jill, it's 50 years since Dolly Parton first released I Will Always Love You. We'll take you through the history of that song and the various renditions.
All right, let's start in Haiti, where the situation on the island nation is growing more chaotic. The U.S. military said on Sunday that it carried out an operation in Haiti to airlift non-essential embassy personnel from the country and added U.S. Marines to bolster embassy security. It comes as the Caribbean nation remains under a state of emergency. The operation was the latest sign of Haiti's troubles as gang violence threatens to bring down the government and has led thousands to flee their homes. Haiti entered a state of emergency last Sunday after fighting escalated while the prime minister, Ariel Henry, was in Africa seeking a deal for the long-delayed UN-backed mission to help him fight the gangs. Henry is now currently stuck in Puerto Rico. He tried to fly back home from Africa, and gangs have pretty much blocked his plane from landing. They are demanding that he resign. Haiti has recently seen mass prison escapes. We're talking thousands of inmates broken out. There has been gunfire at its main airport, the central bank, and a national soccer stadium. Gangs in the country have led a series of coordinated attacks in an effort to overthrow Haiti's government. And now the gangs mostly control the capital. Gangs have attacked police stations and prisons. They have looted seaports and public buildings and shut down the airport, blocking shipments of critical supplies like food. Violence exploded over the weekend with the gangs launching massive attacks on at least three police stations. Caribbean leaders called late Friday for an emergency meeting today in Jamaica. Those countries and the U.S. are working to find some type of resolution here.
Yeah, it's getting worse and worse by the day here. The Haitian gangs, by the way, we should mention there are more than 200 of them, but they work in alliance. And so they control the majority of the capital right now, as well as other parts of the country. And the police force and military in Haiti pale in comparison to the gangs, hence this effort by the Haitian leader, Ariel Henry, to get outside support here. Now, President Biden so far has ruled out sending U.S. troops to directly engage in the crisis there, though we did see that escalation over the weekend as the U.S. put more Marines, at least for the embassy, to protect the embassy and take out some personnel. In October, though, after a year-long campaign by a variety of countries, including Haiti, there was this U.N. resolution put together for an international mission to help Haiti's police force. Now, Kenya is leading that mission. That's why Henry, the prime minister, was in Africa last week talking to the Kenyans about leading that mission. The U.S. Has promised $200 million towards that mission. But right now, they still need about $400 million more from the rest of the world to make sure that happens. And the issue here in the U.S. is while the Biden administration has promised that money, Republican lawmakers in Congress are refusing to release the funding right now. They have a hold on that funding while they have questions about the mission and the rest of the involvement here by the international community. And so while there were these embassy evacuations, the U.S. government says that it is still operating down there, trying to support the Haitian people, mobilize support for the police. But the big issue right now is this conflict between the prime minister and the gangs calling for Henry's resignation. A little background on him. He took over about 3 years ago. He is unelected and also extremely unpopular. He took over following the assassination of the elected president back in 2021. Effectively, Henry was put into power by a bunch of countries around the world, including the U.S. And the U.S. and the rest of the world have been coaxing him to hold an election so the Haitian people can actually elect their leaders over the course of the past few years. Now, Henry has said that things are too unstable for him to hold an election. And while the U.S. has been backing Henry for a while now, in fact, helped put him into place, they have lost patience with them. The Miami Herald reporting in the last few days that during a phone call that Henry had with U.S. officials last week, the U.S. suggested, politely or not so politely, that it might be time for him to go. It might be time for him to resign. Gangs are threatening a civil war, genocide, if he returns to the island. And so Henry right now, as you mentioned, Jill, stuck in Puerto Rico, doesn't know how to get back to the island, given the controls the gangs now have over that island. Now, the U.S. is pushing back on the reports that they were asking him to resign, but then there was a separate Caribbean diplomat who told the Washington Post the U.S. message was very clear and included a suggestion that maybe it's time to resign. So I found this quote over the weekend notable. This is from the former U.S. ambassador to Haiti, James Foley. He tells the Associated Press, "They rode this horse to their doom. Now Haiti's spiraling crisis is the fruit of the choices we made," implying the U.S. here picked Henry as their horse. It has led to further chaos on the island. And Jill, this is the situation we've been watching closely for the past few weeks and doesn't look like it's going to get better before it gets worse, at least at this point in time.
All right, now to the new push on Capitol Hill to force a Chinese company to sell TikTok this year or see the app banned in the United States. The top two U.S. senators who led the Senate Intelligence Committee, Democrat Mark Warner of Virginia and Republican Marco Rubio of Florida, warned Sunday of the threat posed by TikTok and the need to ban it. TikTok is owned by the Chinese company ByteDance. Warner noted that since a large portion of American young people use TikTok as a news source, and because the app collects data that could be available to the Chinese Communist Party, it does pose a serious threat. He calls it perhaps, quote, the most powerful propaganda tool ever. TikTok has been under fire by U.S. officials for years amid warnings that China's government could gain access to its data and use it to manipulate or spy on Americans. But a renewed push targeting TikTok has gained momentum on Capitol Hill in recent days, with a House bill that would compel the company to either sell the app or be banned from U.S. app stores. After passing unanimously by a 50-0 margin out of committee last week, the bill is slated for a vote before the full U.S. House this week. President Biden said Friday that he would sign the legislation if it passes the House and Senate. So if this bill were to become law, TikTok's parent company would have a little bit less than 6 months to sell TikTok in the United States or be banned from apps and web hosting sites in the country.
So while there's been a lot of talk in Washington for a number of years now about this, it appears to have gotten really serious now in the past few months. It comes as, you know, we've told you about some of the congressional hearings, the TikTok CEO in Capitol Hill, and the feeling here among legislators that something has to be done about TikTok, there are concerns in the intelligence community about what the Chinese company could do with American data and how it could push propaganda on users here. Now, TikTok, for its part, denies any issues here and has been pushing against all of these allegations. But what's notable here is the way Congress is approaching it this time is they're trying to steer clear of the free speech issues, and they're really trying to focus in on the Chinese national security threat. Members of Congress are hoping that'll get them past previous legal hurdles that they faced on this. Remember, during the Trump administration, this went to the courts and several judges ruled against this. Just to give you perspective here, it's estimated 170 million people in America use TikTok, effectively half of the population. And not surprisingly, Congress right now, member offices are inundated with phone calls from users who like it for entertainment, as well as creators and businesses who say their livelihood is made on TikTok. TikTok has been pushing this hard. If you open the app, you're greeted with a screenshot warning that Congress is planning a total ban of TikTok. It then asks users for a couple questions, including their zip code, provides them with their Congress member's name, and suggests that they reach out. So TikTok is utilizing the app to actively get people to fight against this ban. Remember, the company here says they are not a security threat. Their headquarters are in LA and Singapore. The app itself is not available in China. In fact, the parent company, ByteDance, has a separate app called Douyin that they use in China. TikTok is the international app. And they claim that the parent company, ByteDance, is not controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, has cabined off its US-based data on cloud servers that are owned by Oracle. But remember that no company really is totally private in China. To operate in China, you have to have the cooperation of the Chinese government and allow a certain amount of deference to the Chinese government. That is where things get murky, because every time the TikTok CEO has been on Capitol Hill and asked about this, you know, there's certain things that are not in his lane, are above him, and that includes the ByteDance Chinese government relationship. So TikTok is able to tell you what it knows at its level in Singapore, in LA.
Moshe, you mentioned how TikTok is encouraging its users to reach out to their member of Congress or their senator to say that they were against this ban. Sapna at the New York Times, who had written that article about Mo News and how more people are getting their news on Instagram, she posted something really interesting a couple of days ago about how perhaps that idea is backfiring, because it is showing how powerful TikTok is and how much control TikTok has over the people who use it, that all of these lawmakers are basically being flooded with phone calls.
Yeah, the lawmakers say that you guys are pawns of the Chinese government and this app, and now I'm getting thousands of phone calls because they told you to do something. So you're reinforcing why we're trying to ban this app. You know, I would be curious, Jill, you know, if there was any other company or app that people are passionate about, I imagine they would be getting similar pushback from their users. And by the way, TikTok is not alone here. Every time there is a piece of legislation that impacts, you know, everything from credit cards to consumer products here in the US, companies do try to get their fans, their consumers involved here. But, you know, your point is well taken and was utilized on some of the political shows over the weekend by various members.
The other thing she said is that the last time around when lawmakers contemplated banning TikTok, it didn't happen. But when they were thinking about it, China basically said, sorry, that we're not going to allow that to happen. which basically proved the point again that China does control this company.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of rules you got to play by if you want to operate in China, especially if you're a Chinese company, but also if you're an American company. We've talked about this, you know, what Elon Musk has to do to get Tesla in China, what Apple has to do to work with China. There's a lot of ways you have to bend for the Chinese government here. Jill, one other thing that bears watching here as we talk about whether this legislation will go down or whether it'll pass is how the two presidents, Biden and Trump, are talking about this. You mentioned that Biden says he will sign this, and that's notable because his campaign just joined TikTok during the Super Bowl like a month ago, which has gotten a lot of criticism because he's also been very critical of TikTok itself. So people are wondering, even Mark Warner, a Democrat on the senator you mentioned from the Intelligence Committee, was like, yeah, it doesn't jive for me as a Democrat. Like, Biden says he'll sign this, but he also just joined it during the Super Bowl. Now, what is also notable is former President Trump. Remember whose idea it was to first ban TikTok? Former President Trump. That was a big push for him during his presidency. He talked about that for a while. Republicans are almost nearly united in lockstep here in terms of banning the app. Well, where does Trump stand now? He's against it, as in against the ban. He's supportive of TikTok. In fact, over on his Truth Social media platform on Thursday, he wrote the following. If you get rid of TikTok, Facebook and Zuckerschmuck, a reference to Zuckerberg, will double their business. I don't want Facebook, who cheated in the last election, doing better. They are the true enemy of the people. So Trump, who spearheaded the original TikTok ban, believes that banning TikTok will make Meta more powerful. He sees, his campaign sees, how well his clips do on TikTok. Now, while he's not officially on TikTok, Trump clips, a lot of ultra-conservatives, MAGA supporters are on TikTok, and they believe that Instagram and Facebook are biased against him. Remember, Trump was banned from those platforms after January 6th. He's now back on them. That said, there's no overt statement as to why he made this switch, but the theory goes, A, as I mentioned, his content related to him and MAGA, does very well on TikTok. Theory two, he understands that right now young voters are disenchanted with Biden. So he's not going to do anything that upsets young voters and maybe their willingness to consider him in this election. So he's like, well, I'll let Biden ban the most popular app among young people and I'll support it. Why not? So he's made that move. And then one other factor thrown out by Axios over the weekend is that Trump is now very close to billionaire Jeff Yass. He has a huge financial stake in ByteDance, has spent millions backing lawmakers who support TikTok. He donated a whole bunch to the Vivek Ramaswamy campaign. Vivek was another person who was very critical of TikTok, but then joined TikTok himself. And so you see this interesting divide now in the Republican Party. They're not sure where to go because for the most part, they were all united on this. But now Trump, effectively the head of the party, is like, no, we don't need to ban TikTok. Meta's the real enemy, the American company. So you did see some Republicans over the weekend, conservative commentators, Laura Ingraham from Fox, saying this is a big mistake by the Trump campaign. Josh Hawley, the Republican senator from Missouri, who's also very close to Trump, saying, I'm not a fan of Facebook, but TikTok is qualitatively different. It's a backdoor for the Chinese Communist Party. So this divide within the Republican Party, I think, is fascinating. And this Trump flip-flop on TikTok is something that we'll have to watch this week and see how many House Republicans and Senate Republicans are impacted by it, because he does have an incredible influence over Republican lawmakers.
All right, Moshe, we have plenty of news coming up, but now a word from a couple of our sponsors. First up, Good Chop, which offers fully customizable boxes of high-quality meat and seafood delivered straight to your door on your schedule. The products are vacuum-sealed and frozen at peak freshness, so you can stock your freezer and cook when you want. Choose from over 70 high-quality cuts, 100% grass-fed ribeyes, USDA, prime, filet mignon. They also offer sustainable and wild-caught seafood like salmon, Pacific cod, scallops, shrimp, and more. Moshe, we recently cooked the salmon in my house. It was absolutely delicious and really easy and nice to know that it was an option and we could do it whenever it was convenient for us. Now, unlike many other companies, Good Chop sources its meat and seafood exclusively from American farms and fisheries, so you can support local family farms and independent ranchers right here in the U.S., and it doesn't cost a fortune. Good Chop's price per meal starts at just $3.74. Good Chop especially prides itself on sourcing meat that comes with no antibiotics or added hormones ever. There are no artificial ingredients, only the good stuff. They are so confident in the quality of their cuts that they offer a 100% money-back guarantee. Go to goodchop.com/monews120 and use the code monews120 to get $120 off across your first four boxes. That is monews120 at goodchop.com/monews120 for $120 off.
All right, one more sponsor we want to get to today, longtime partner of ours here at Mo News, Athletic Greens AG1 powder. We're always talking about health trends, food trends, how difficult it is to get all of the nutrients that you need for your body on a daily basis. And one way to try to get all the important ones is Athletic Greens AG1 powder. I first tried it more than a year ago. It's just one scoop with a glass of water in the morning. It's easy. It's quick. It lets you get on with your day knowing that you've gotten over 75 important ingredients, including tons of vitamins and minerals. It also has pre and probiotics to support digestion and gut health. Jill, it comes up all the time from the Mo News fans, including at our Mo News team meetup recently, where some people were asking about AG1. Did you and Jill really try it? I'm like, yes, yes. We only endorse and partner with products that we try first. Important to note that. So with your first purchase of AG1, they're offering a special deal to the Mo News community. Athletic Greens is giving Mo News listeners a free one-year supply of vitamin D and five free travel packs of AG1. You can visit drinkag1.com/monews. That is drinkag1.com/monews to take advantage of this offer. You can get a discounted monthly subscription or try it just one time for 1 month. Again, one more time, the number one, drinkag1.com/monews for the special deal.
Time now for the speed read from Axios. A major divide between President Biden and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu grew even wider this weekend. Biden said in an interview that the Israeli prime minister is, quote, hurting Israel more than helping Israel in how he is approaching its war in Gaza. While Biden told NBC that he expresses support for Israel's right to destroy Hamas after the October 7th attack, he said of Netanyahu, he must pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken. He said the death toll in Gaza, where upwards of about 15 to 20,000 civilians have been killed during this war, is, quote, contrary to what Israel stands for, and I think it is a big mistake. Biden said that a potential Israeli invasion of the Gaza city of Rafah, where more than 1.3 million Palestinians are sheltering, is a, quote, red line for him. That is the area where what remains of Hamas leadership appears to be hiding, and Israel believes many of the hostages are also being held there. Biden said that while he doesn't approve of an invasion of Rafah, he would not cut off weapons from Israel, telling NBC, I am never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical, so there is no red line where I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them.
The Iron Dome being the anti-missile system that protects them and shoots down the majority of rockets coming in from Hezbollah, coming in from Hamas as well. What Biden's trying to do here is a very tricky maneuver, breaking up with Netanyahu and the Gaza war strategy while sticking with Israel and its fight against Hamas, which is still holding hostages, including, we should note, American hostages. Based on Axios reporting here, they say that there was no one incident that led Biden to start changing his course with Netanyahu, whom he has known for four decades now, but an accumulation of events and decisions by the prime minister over time. By the way, this also comes against the backdrop here domestically, where Biden has seen increasingly the progressive left, younger voters, Arab American voters, as he's starting to lose them on this issue. And you've seen that, as we reported last week, with the uncommitted vote in states like Michigan, Minnesota, and other places. So this happens against electoral politics, 2024 politics. You can imagine this would be different if this was an election year, but given this is an election year at the White House, it's not lost on them that they are losing a segment of Democrats here. Hence the pushback, the increasing pushback you saw, especially with Biden's remarks during the State of the Union Thursday night and this interview over the weekend. He apparently hoped at the White House that he would be able to push this Saudi mega deal, a deal at the end of the war, hoping this would incentivize the war to be cut shorter, that would allow for a Saudi recognition of Israel. This is considered the sort of big kahuna in the Middle East, the home of Islam's holiest sites recognizing the Jewish state. This was a negotiation happening for a couple of years now, was on the verge of happening in the fall when Hamas attacked by the way, one of the reasons Hamas attacked here was to stop that deal. Biden said there was still hope for the deal after this war started, but he's losing hope here. He sees the deal slipping away. Biden's extremely frustrated by what he sees as ungratefulness from Netanyahu, given how much support, how much incoming Biden has taken on this issue, the domestic political cost over the past 5 months. And Biden's not alone here. His predecessors have all had issues with Netanyahu, who has been a prime minister on and off over the course of the past three decades. Bill Clinton had a breakup with Netanyahu. Barack Obama had a breakup with Bibi. And Donald Trump did too. Now, Clinton's and Obama's came over issue differences. Trump's breakup with Bibi was more about the fact that Netanyahu would not support Trump's assertions that he won the election and Biden's election was illegitimate. So he broke up with Bibi after Netanyahu sent a congratulatory note to President Biden. Nevertheless, Biden here follows a string of presidents who've had issues with the Israeli prime minister. But it does come at a crucial time here for Israel as this war takes place. So we're going to have to see how this transpires in the coming days and weeks here. Netanyahu, it has replied in an interview with Politico on Sunday. He says he doesn't exactly know what the president meant by saying that his leadership is hurting Israel more than helping it, but that Biden is effectively wrong here. Netanyahu telling the newspaper, "The Israeli people support my position that says that we should resoundingly reject the attempt to ram down our throats a Palestinian state. That is something they all agree on." Netanyahu defends his strategy here. Now, Netanyahu in particular is not that popular in Israel, but the war is popular. And the larger point has been made that even if he was to leave, there isn't that much room between him and the other people who might take over as far as the strategy about getting hostages back and destroying Hamas.
And Moshe, I know we mentioned it at the top of the podcast, but Ramadan, the Muslim holiday, starts today, which means, at least as of this recording, there is not a ceasefire hostage deal in place by the time that the holiday begins.
Yeah, there was hope for that. They're still negotiating here. The latest deal was that Israel offered a six-week ceasefire. Hamas said they would offer up 40 hostages, 40 of the 100-plus Israelis that are still being held in Gaza. They demanded a whole bunch of prisoners in return. Israel eventually agreed to a 10-to-1 exchange, 10 Palestinian prisoners for every one Israeli hostage based on Hamas demands, including, by the way, prisoners in Israeli jails who have killed Israelis. But it appears there's a divide here within Hamas over what to do. Hamas saying, you know, at least Gaza leadership of Hamas saying, we want all Israeli troops out. We want a permanent ceasefire. We will not agree to a six-week ceasefire. The Hamas leadership outside of Gaza over in Qatar saying, let's just agree to the deal as Palestinians are dying here. The leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, apparently writing a letter to his brethren, according to the Wall Street Journal, in the last week, saying that he sees the situation unfolding badly for Israel. He wants the war to continue. He sees that more Palestinians dead in Gaza is actually good for their cause and is inflaming tensions further, especially during the Ramadan holiday when tens of millions will be out to pray, will be walking back from mosque. It's an opportunity as people are out of school, out of work. The hope from the Gaza-based Hamas is that people join the cause, that violence starts up across the region, especially in Jerusalem and the West Bank. So that was one of the reasons they wanted to get a deal before Ramadan here. Interesting anecdote too, Jill. The Wall Street Journal also reports that apparently the Qatari leadership has told Hamas if they don't get a ceasefire deal, they're going to kick some of those leaders out of Doha. They're upset at them that they've gone to lengths to help Hamas here, and Hamas can't help itself. That has not been confirmed by other sources, but still notable that there's this room here, this space here, between the Qataris and Hamas right now.
And over the weekend, the U.S. sent the head of the CIA, William Burns, back to the area to continue negotiations.
Yeah, the feeling is that the intelligence heads are less political, and so they can come up with a better deal here. So you saw the Israeli head of the Mossad, the CIA head, Egyptian intelligence heads trying to strike a deal here away from the politicians.
All right, from ABC News, Moshe, given how late the State of the Union went, we didn't really get a chance to chat about the Republican response to the Biden address on Friday, but it has gotten a ton of attention, especially over the weekend. So Republican Alabama Senator Katie Britt delivered the response. Traditionally, the party out of power has 15 to 20 minutes for a response after the president's State of the Union. The 42-year-old senator, who is the youngest woman to ever be elected to the Senate, she criticized the president over his border policies and took shots at his age, working to make the case for returning Republicans to the White House. However, her extremely dramatic, unnatural delivery, which wavered from joy to anger to sadness and back again, has received a ton of attention and criticism, including from Republican leaders who felt that it really did their side a disservice. The setting was also an issue, with Britt delivering the speech from her kitchen table, many women wondering why an accomplished senator was put there for her speech. Her fellow Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville said that she was chosen because she is a housewife.
Yeah, he had to be reminded, no, she's your fellow senator from Alabama. Another misspeak by Tuberville there.
So just a lot happening. And then there is an issue with one of the major parts of her speech related to the border and sex trafficking. Most just a lot of fact checks out over the weekend.
Yeah, we should note here, you know, some people were wondering whether they're specifically going after Britt because she's a woman. And, you know, I've tried to note to people, the response to the State of the Union has a long, tortured, terrible history. It's why most people avoid giving that response.
But like, if somebody asks you to do it, just say no.
just say no. Like, you know, some people say it helped destroy Bobby Jindal, a Louisiana governor's career. Marco Rubio gave one where he drank water in the middle of it. It's just like, it's shorter by like an hour or more than the main speech. But like, it never works.
It's like cursed.
No matter the setting, male, female, Democrat, Republican, it's cursed. The response is cursed. So Britt had the unfortunate role Thursday night of giving this response. And so, you know, people made issue with the fact that, like, she didn't sound like herself. When she talks normal, you know, she's very convincing. She's very compelling. She does have a future in this party. But it appears that, you know, some people spent a lot of time rehearsing with her, and it didn't feel natural. It was uncomfortable to watch at times. I'm still trying to get to the bottom of why they chose the kitchen setting. I mean, it makes sense because it's kitchen table issues. She was saying this is where we have serious discussions. But still, you know, an accomplished woman like sitting at, you know, a senator sitting at a kitchen table just reinforces the wrong thing. And there was a Republican pollster out over the weekend, by the way, who mentioned, like, what are we doing as a party? Like, I'm a Republican. Like, we've pulled this. Like, this does not play well with women. It feels like you're literally putting women back in the kitchen.
And we mentioned just the tone that she was speaking in, and maybe it was just over-rehearsed. But some people were pointing out that she did kind of this preview saying, like, hey, it's Senator, like a normal and a normal voice saying.
Oh, she posted on social media her normal voice. Like, hey, everyone, tune in later for my response. Totally normal. Like, oh, this is compelling. Like, I'll watch this. And then the actual response itself was just very she had spent a lot of time preparing which things to. Anyway, needless to say, if you actually read the response, there's some compelling arguments there for the Republican side. But there was the delivery issue and the setting issue. Now, all that aside for a second, one of the issues people are taking with the response here is that she dove into the border, which we know is a big issue here this election year. But as she was criticizing Biden's border policies, she described the experience of a woman she had heard from who was the victim of human trafficking. Now, I should say here to parents listening, if you're listening with your kids right now, you may want to skip through the next minute or so, just as we describe what she described in the speech. Now, Britt talks about a couple visits she made to the border as she became senator, including a one where she heard from a woman who had been abused sexually, had been trafficked. Now, this all came as she's talking about Biden's border policies and people getting through the U.S. southern border. The issue with the anecdote is that the abuse the woman endured took place between 2004 and 2008 in Mexico. Take a listen to a bit of what Senator Britt had to say Thursday night.
I traveled to the Del Rio sector of Texas. That's where I spoke to a woman who shared her story with me. She had been sex trafficked by the cartels starting at the age of 12. We wouldn't be okay with this happening in a third world country. This is the United States of America, and it is past time, in my opinion, that we start acting like it.
So that's a bit of Senator Britt there. She got into very precise detail about what took place, the terrible crimes that happened to this woman, which we won't play the full clip of, but you can certainly find on YouTube. The notable thing here, again, is she was talking about Biden's border policies, but she doesn't date this occurrence or note that, again, it happened in Mexico, even though, you know, she makes the third world reference in the speech there. The woman, her name is Carla Jacinto Romero, was interviewed over the weekend, and she learned about Britt's remarks, and she's said that she found them very strange, because she's out there fighting human trafficking and doesn't want it to be political, and finds that, you know, effectively the way Britt told the story, misleading. Now, Britt was confronted on Fox News Sunday about this yesterday. She defended the remarks, saying she didn't specifically say this happened under Biden, even though the anecdote came among a bunch of arguments against Biden. And she effectively implied this happened in the U.S. So she's very careful with her words in the speech. She's defending the actions over the weekend. She said in her defense that Biden's policies serve as a magnet to help more and more people come here. So implying that more of this sort of thing could happen because of Biden's policies. Either way, expect to hear more about this in the coming days and months as the immigration debate continues here. Jill also, over the weekend, it got the Saturday Night Live treatment. Scarlett Johansson played Katie Britt over the weekend in the cold open of SNL.
My husband Wesley and I just watched President Biden's speech, and what I saw was the performance of a permanent politician. But me, I'm not performing. I'm not.
For those wondering how Johansson ended up in the show, she's married to the head writer of SNL, Colin Jost. And I think she did a pretty good impression, Jill.
Moshe, I was laughing out loud. I thought she did a great job.
We should note the previous week, SNL really took it to Joe Biden on his age. And then this week, they went after Katie Britt, which is another thing that Republicans or conservatives brought up. They're like, listen, just as we've converted SNL to start to be critical of Joe Biden, given how left-leaning Saturday Night Live is, we, you know, did ourselves a disservice with that response on Thursday. And staying with weekend entertainment here, Sunday night was Oscar night. This from The Hollywood Reporter. Oppenheimer kept off an incredible award season, winning 7 Oscars last night, including Best Picture, Director, Actor, Supporting Actor, Original Score, Cinematography, and Film Editing. The historical epic, which was the number 2 grossing movie of 2023, got actors Cillian Murphy and Robert Downey Jr. their first Oscars for Best Actor and Supporting Actor, respectively. While Christopher Nolan won for the first time for Best Director, it was his first win for Best Director following 8 nominations over the course of the past couple decades. The big wins for Oppenheimer is the return of the blockbuster winner for the Oscars. So many best films through recent years over the past couple decades have gone to smaller, artsy films, many that most viewers have not been familiar with. Oppenheimer is the highest grossing Best Picture winner since Lord of the Rings back in 2003. As for the other 2023 blockbuster, Barbie, it did get a win last night for Best Original Song. Billie Eilish and her brother won for the ballad What Was I Made For. It actually competed against itself in that category, where I'm Just Ken was also nominated. That was one of the more fun performances last night. Ryan Gosling, who played Ken, performing the song alongside Mark Ronson and Slash. There was also a fun segment earlier in the evening with Ryan Gosling of Barbie and Emily Blunt of Oppenheimer, where they took shots at each other in a very fun way, and the rivalry of Barbenheimer last year. Back to the awards here for a second. Emma Stone won her 2nd Oscar for Best Actress for Poor Things. She got her first award a few years back for La La Land. In a very emotional speech last night, she broke down a couple times. She said, "The other night I was panicking that maybe something like this could happen." And as for Best Supporting Actress, that went to Devine Joy Randolph from The Holdover. It was her first ever award. She also gave quite a powerful speech last night. Here's a bit of it.
"I didn't think I was supposed to be doing this as a career. I started off as a singer. And my mother said to me, go across that street to that theater department. There's something for you there. And I thank my mother for doing that."
It was actually Mother's Day in the UK yesterday, so a number of the Brits actually also thanked their mothers on stage last night. Politics is never very far from these awards, and it wasn't far from the Oscars last night. This year, the conflict in the Middle East, the Israel-Hamas war, was the focus for a few stars who wore red lapel pins. You might have seen those last night. Those pins are meant to symbolize an immediate ceasefire. Billie Eilish, Mark Ruffalo, and Rami Youssef were among those wearing the pins. One of the speeches last night from an award winner for Best International Film also dove into the conflict. Writer-director Jonathan Glazer from Zone of Interest, that's a film that takes place during the Holocaust, gave an acceptance speech standing alongside a fellow producer, James Wilson, of the film. In his remarks, Glazer said that they are men who, quote, refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people, whether the victims of October 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza. all are victims of dehumanization. Their remarks were hotly contested and debated all over social media last night in my feed. The remarks getting applause from Palestinian supporters and critics on the Israeli side, who said Glazer was absolving Hamas and terrorists of any blame in the conflict. A couple lighter items before we leave the Oscars here for a second. A couple fun cameos last night, including John Cena in the buff, completely nude last night, presenting best costume design. It was a fun segment with Jimmy Kimmel, the host last night, actually to mark the 50th anniversary of a streaker crossing the stage back in the 1974 Oscars. So they had fun with John Cena on that front last night. Also, a fun reunion for Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito. You might remember them from Twins, also as the former Batman adversaries. They had fun with each other, and that clip got some pickup online as well, especially as they went after Michael Keaton, who played Batman in those films. They had a bit of fun there in that segment, recalling the movie. Towards the end of the awards, it turned out Donald Trump was watching last night and took to Truth Social to criticize Jimmy Kimmel. Trump posting, "Has there ever been a worse host than Jimmy Kimmel at the Oscars? His opening was that of less than an average person trying too hard to be something which he is not and never can be." Jimmy Kimmel read part of the post, then towards the end just went, "Blah, blah, blah, make America great again." Kimmel saying, "I'm surprised you're still up. Isn't it past your jail time?" Making reference to Trump's legal cases. So politics, again, never very far from the Oscars.
From CNN, self-checkout annoys many grocery shoppers and causes problems that are prompting numerous major retailers to pull back on using it. But it appears that is not stopping the TSA from testing its own version of self-service screening systems at the Harry Reid International Airport in Vegas. TSA pre-check passengers at the airport will be the first travelers to have the option to use the new system starting today. The TSA says the prototype has a video monitor that provides step-by-step instructions for passengers to complete screening at their own pace. After passengers complete the required screening process and are cleared for travel, automated exit doors open so travelers can gather their belongings and head to their flights. Apparently, transportation security officers can help as needed.
Yeah, we posted a video of this on Instagram, on our Instagram account on Friday. A lot of people asking, what could go wrong with a self-service TSA screening? Though they are starting this very small, this is a prototype here. The idea is not to replace these officers completely, but help make the process go quicker, smoother, improve the customer experience. It's one of the things that most people don't like is the TSA screening experience. So the TSA will still be performing the scanning of the bags. Like, you're not going to be scanning your own bags, at least not yet, according to the system, but you will be going through the scanner yourself and, you know, ensuring your pockets are empty and following various directions.
Didn't find anything.
Exactly. Like, I'm not carrying anything on me. They still will be under oversight here of transportation security officers. The goal here is that apparently for every two lanes at the airport, right now it requires about 12 officers total. They're hoping they can take it down to 8 officers with this new self-screening for every two lanes. Keep in mind, TSA has already screened 143 million people so far this year alone. And so they go through a lot of people. So they're trying to find ways to make things more efficient, more effective, and again, improve the customer experience without jeopardizing safety. So we'll see how this goes. Apparently, you can opt in next time you fly to Vegas or fly out of Vegas to be part of this experiment over the next few weeks. Jill, as long as they don't have what my biggest frustration with the self-service checkout at grocery stores is that, like, it doesn't detect that you put something in the bag. Like, they're like, you know, like, you didn't scan torture. That because it has that little weighted thing for the bag because you put it on the side. And anyway, as long as it's not like checking out individual items because it didn't detect my pack of gum, I'm okay with it, I think. We'll see how it goes.
And finally, from the Daily Telegraph, the first official photograph of Catherine, Princess of Wales, since she underwent abdominal surgery in January, was released over the weekend. Kate is seen sitting outside, surrounded by her three kids, Prince George, Princess Charlotte, and Prince Louis, in a photo credited to the Prince of Wales. Sunday marked Mother's Day in the UK. In a post on their official Instagram account alongside the photo, the message said, "Thank you for your kind wishes and continued support over the last 2 months, wishing everyone a happy Mother's Day." And then that message was signed off by C, which is Catherine.
So she's 42. She's recovering from surgery in Windsor. She's unlikely to return to public duties until after Easter, probably later in the spring. But we still don't know all these months later what the surgery was for. They just said it was non-cancerous, but it still remains a mystery. And her absence from the public eye, as well as William, her husband, pulling out of an important family event recently, has only contributed to what they call the Katespiracy, a wave of gossip and speculation as to what is happening to the princess. Jill, add to that right now allegations that this image was manipulated by the palace. Several outlets, including the Associated Press, gave out kill notifications saying, don't distribute this image anymore. There appear to be some weird edits around her hand, around her daughter's hands. There's also a missing wedding ring in the photo. She's not wearing her wedding ring. So if they were looking to quash issues or rumors, it appears, at least late on this Sunday, that there's just more in the Katespiracy realm. We won't engage in it too much, just to say it's out there and people are talking about it.
I'm certainly not above royal gossip, Mosh, but I think I'm on team leave Kate alone at this point. I mean, the poor woman, she just had this abdominal surgery.
If the palace wants to put out a manipulated image, I mean, let them put out a manipulated image. The AP is like, oh, the image was manipulated. You think it was put out by the palace?
Well, I don't know, Moshe. I kind of feel like if they're going to put out a photo to quell the rumors, it should be a real photo.
No edits.
Yeah.
Well, it appears to be a real photo, but they've taken some liberties with the edits there. Anyway,
she does we'll keep look you, good.
She looks great. The kids look great. We're wishing her a quick recovery. We're also looking for some, you know, I think there's a lot of people out there looking for some basic detail system. What exactly happened? All right, now time for On This Day in History, as we typically end the podcast. Let's begin in 1931, Jill. Rupert Murdoch was born in Australia. I only mentioned that. We don't often do birthdays here. He turns 93 today. Is because he announced recently he's about to get married for the fifth time, the 93-year-old. He announced it last week, his sixth engagement. He talks about how much he loves love. Jill, he can't get enough.
Him and J-Lo.
Him and J-Lo. But the Rupert, the billionaire, Fox founder, has been married again four times, engaged five times. He actually had an engagement a couple years ago that he broke off. He's got six kids from the first three wives, very adult children who have their own children at this time. I posted a bit of it on the Instagram on Friday. Apparently, this won't affect the trust because everyone goes to Succession. Because, remember, Succession, the HBO show, sort of loosely based on both the Murdochs, but also the Redstones, the family that owned CBS and Paramount and Viacom. So a happy 93rd birthday to Rupert Murdoch on this day. All right, on this day in 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev was selected as the new General Secretary of the Soviet Union following the death of Cherninko, the previous leader. Gorbachev, one of the most famous leaders of the Soviet Union, also the last. He oversaw radical transformation in the Soviet Union over his 6 years in office. A dizzying pace of domestic reforms, foreign policy changes, going a bit softer on their military control over the various countries. And it appears it was too fast, too much, too quickly. The Soviet Union would fall apart under his reign. And by the time he's done in 1991, the Soviet Union no longer exists. On this day in 2011, an earthquake struck off the coast of Japan, causing widespread damage in the country, leading to that tsunami that killed about 20,000 people up in northern Japan. It also severely damaged the Fukushima nuclear plant, leading to the second worst nuclear disaster in history over there in Japan. They're still dealing with the ramifications of it. It led to the initial relocation of 100,000 people. And on this day in 2020, the World Health Organization declared COVID a pandemic 4 years ago today. Jill, we'll end here with a bit of pop culture history. On this day 27 years ago, Paul McCartney of the Beatles was officially knighted by Queen Elizabeth for his services to music. 50 years ago on this day, March 11th, 1974, this was Dolly Parton's new hit. And I will always love you. Jill, there's a creator on Instagram, Jared Germain. He's got a couple million followers. He also follows Mo News. He puts together excellent mashups of music history and the origin of songs, like where the certain beat evolved or originated and then went through various versions. He put together a recent video going through various singers, top singers, their renditions of I Will Always Love You. So I just want to play that. This is Christina Aguilera, Ariana Grande, Whitney Houston, and then the OG, Dolly Parton, who wrote the song, performing the song. I will always love you. So while so many of us associated with Whitney Houston and her incredible rendition, we're going to give a shout out to Dolly Parton here. But Jill, in that mashup, I will say Ariana Grande, her pipes, pretty incredible there.
Most you posted this over on the Instagram account, as you mentioned. I was blown away by Ariana Grande. I wasn't expecting it. Obviously, the bar is set really high by Whitney Houston, of course, but I thought they all did great.
And finally here, Jill, a little moment in TV history. 35 years ago, March 11th, 1989, on Rupert Murdoch's little network that he was trying to build out called Fox, they premiered the show Cops on this day in 1989. Many of you may recognize the theme song. Jill, the show would last until 2020, when in the aftermath of Black Lives Matter and the pushback on police led to Cops' cancellation.
All right, Mosh, big thank you to everyone out there listening to the Mo News podcast. If you like what you hear, share this with your friends. It will help us grow. Follow us and subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and review us in the App Store.
See you tomorrow, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Mo News podcast.